construction of the hex beam. Back to you, Dick, and to RSO.
Okay, I thank you, Frank. That's good stuff. Alrighty. Looks like we're giving that antenna a moderately good good housekeeping seal of approval. a preliminary, temporary preliminary housekeeping seal of approval for that antenna is what I think this particular assembled group is giving. Let me pass it back to Kent for any final words on that one. If we should giving it the good housekeeping seal of approval, WA5EJB with a big delay, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, WA5EJB again. If you're looking for gain, you're not going to get it, but it does have a front to back ratio. It's got a couple of dB gain in front to back, so you can use it to null people out. And if you've got a garden apartment or a very small backyard or trying to operate for a portable area, it's a reasonable antenna. Like I said, it's got some directivity to it, not a lot. And that's about all I got. WA5EJB.
Pretty fine, Ken. By the way, in the to the AQFGK, Andy Furlong response. Thank goodness he included a little bit of the response that came from a guy named Bill, November 6th, G8Z. So Andy got a response from G8Z. I did not. What's going on here, I think, is there is a number of individual VHF microwave nets or listservs, some of which are coupled and some of them are not. So this person probably thought he's responding to me, and he didn't put the right addresses on top, so he didn't put it on to Tom Williams, the WA1MBA's microwave listserv. Therefore, I wonder how many other people are replying to me, and I'm not getting it, if you know what I mean. So have you seen, I saw the reply from Jerry, K0CQ, and now, by way of WA2FGK, I'm seeing the reply indirectly from N6G8Z. But I didn't get that one directly. I wonder, to your knowledge, Ken, were there other replies that you're getting because you're on every one of those lists, and I'm not getting because I get more email than I know what to handle. So I'm only on the WA1MGA microwave listserv. I'm not on the others. So were there other replies that I'm missing is my quick question to you, Ken. WA5EJB, KQRIW.
Only the one I said a few seconds ago, WA5EJB.
Okay. Looks like I haven't missed a whole lot. I was afraid I was. I think we've answered that question, Mel. I'll pass it back to you with delays in case anyone wants to add something, and then you can go on to the next letter if you want to. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Very good. Oh, I've got a lot of antenna questions about antennas here. You know, most of them are situations here I see fitting into, in other words, these are not people that have the Texas land, I guess our land here is postage stamps for Texas, basically. I remember I was out there, I spent some time out there in Houston area and all, and I know when you get right out of the town there, boy, big, big country. Okay, anyhow, here's another one. I'm also, here's another one about with stealth antennas, a problem. I live in an apartment. I have tried a number of indoor antennas. Nothing really works. I love to get on and do some operating on 20 meters with some kind of antenna. A friend of mine says that you can wind. Let me see if I can read this correctly. I only have approximately outside the windowsill with about 10 feet of space to work with. Can I wind a 20 meter dipole up that'll fit into a 10-foot space and it still still work. Gee, I don't know. Can you wind a helical pipe? I remember if you took a form and you took a half-wave dipole for 20 meters, if you wound it to 10 feet or 5 feet on each side, how would it perform? I really, that would be really squeezing it down a bit, Dick. Am I correct, over?
To make a magnet antenna.
It's not as bad as you think, Alex, as a magnet antenna. You can take a half-wave dipole at 20 meters, which is normally in the vicinity of 32 feet long, and could you squeeze it down to a 10-foot total length? Absolutely. By helical winding? Absolutely. I talked to people in the past who did exactly that. The particular guy was living in the New York City area. I'll admit he had one huge advantage. He was at the 20th or 22nd floor of an apartment building, and he had a balcony outside of his apartment. But with that half-wave helical wound antenna, that's the important part, half-wave, not quarter-wave. So electronically, it was 32 feet long, even though mechanically it was something like 10 feet long. And he fed it from the bottom, not from the center. And he was using as his counterpoise the railing on his balcony. That was the counterpoise, that was the grounded portion. And with the right kind of an impedance in that matching network, which stepped up the impedance at the end of the helical halfway winding, for something like 800 ohms or whatever, a very high number, he radiated with that and got out very well. So if you build it out of low loss material, the antenna's going to be narrowband as all hell. You QSY 10KC and you're going to have to retune. But as long as you tune it to your favorite frequency, you can squeeze down with low enough loss material a 32-foot antenna into 10 feet, absolutely. And radiate 90-some-odd% of the power you put into it, absolutely. And so if you're smart enough to be able to make an impedance match to feed it from one end, you can make that work. Now, no matter what you use as an antenna, if you're down at street level and you're in the marble canyons of Manhattan, New York City, no matter what you use down there, getting out into the real atmosphere, into the ionosphere, is going to be extremely difficult. But if he's got a little bit of local clearance, and if he's willing to build antennas like that, I say he gets high performance. I didn't say it's easy. It's going to be narrowband. It's going to require some tweaking. It's an unpopular style. In other words, to find references as to how to build such a thing is going to be a little bit difficult. But don't give up. In my opinion, it's there. He can get the performance he wants. K2K
repeater, timeout.
I'll try again. K2KEY. K2RAW. Go ahead, Mel.
This is K2KEY. I know some strange things take place with people operating out of city. In fact, he will go mentionless, who I'm thinking of. He has he lives in the city, and a friend of his lives across the street and also one of the high rises. And they went ahead, I'm telling you the truth, Dick, they stretched a wire across a main avenue in the city from one apartment to the other. And he's using that as an antenna. And I know where it is, and I'm telling you, it just flabbergasted me. There's a wire going across a main street in Manhattan from one apartment to the other, and it's being used for amateur radio purposes. So nothing surprises me anymore. That is a sight to behold. So that's the story. It can be done. Okay. And that's it. I've got so many here of questions, basically, all basically boiling down to how do you do this and that. And mostly in restricted problems here in the New York area, where, of course, it's not the old apartment houses around and everything and buildings around here. We could go up to the roof and put up an antenna. They all removed all the TV antennas and everything from these roofs, so you just can't sneak up an amateur radio antenna that wouldn't be, noticed anymore, over.
I have a question, Dick, unrelated, but still antennas.
Okay. And by the way, Alex recognized, going to get you in a second. Anything the guy can do to get the antenna outside of his apartment is going to help. There's an amazing number of apartments that have got wire lathing in the walls and metal girders in the structure, and some of these things do act like a anechoic chamber or like a screen room, and getting RF energy out of it is quite difficult. So once he gets the antenna on the outside of the property, his only other real requirement, from my point of view, is for the antenna internally to hit resonance, like a halfway dipole, balanced resonance. If you get that, and you make it out of low-loss materials, no matter how small you shrink the antenna, no matter how high the Q gets and how narrow band it gets, you can radiate 90-some-odd percent of your RF energy into space, and people will hear you. I'll admit that, as I said before, down at ground level, they may not hear you because you're so darn well shielded. And at first, everyone thinks that shrinking down an antenna is going to lower the performance. That is not necessarily true. The infinitesimal dipole section of the respected antenna book makes this clear. N2NNU, H2RIW, you got it, Alex.
Yeah, okay, this is a question I wanted for a long time to ask here on this forum, but I always forgot. I'm starting now to get the extra, to the extra certification. There is a question that got me scratching my head. The question says that if you have a dish antenna, and if you double its diameter, how much gain you gain? 3 dB, 6 dB, or 9 dB? The correct answer is 3 dB, which got me scratching my head a little bit. I think the question is misleading at the first time. What do you think about that, Dick?
It sounds like there's a huge error there, Alex. Huge error. The formula for the gain of any antenna, gain equals 4 pi A over lambda squared, where A is effective area. If you're working at a constant frequency where lambda doesn't change, gain is a constant times area. If you want the antenna to double in gain, you must double its area. By definition, in the case of a parabolic dish antenna, you double its diameter, and area equals 4 pi r squared, you're doubling its radius, or you could say it's pi d squared over 4. Doubling the area, I mean double the diameter, must quadruple the area. Therefore, if you feed it correctly, the bigger dish has to have 6.02 decibels more gain. So, just because a guy prepared a license manual, a question and answer license manual, just because it's printed and published by a respected organization, doesn't mean that an error doesn't sneak in from time to time. From what you've told me, there seems to be only a 2-to-1 error there. It is 6 dB of gain in my book. And me and Kent and a lot of other people who use dish antennas all the time have seen this phenomena time and time again. Double diameter, you got 4 dB more real gain, which is 6 dB in decibels. N2NNU, K2RIW.
Right. This is true. However, it's only half of the puzzlement, because they are not specifying if they're talking about receiving gain or transmitting gain, which you probably discussed the transmitting gain, but you realize that when you're talking about receiving gain, the constant is 20 logs rather than 10 logs, so your numbers are double here. So do you think they should specify if it is on transmitter or receiver?
Okay, you and I may have a little bit of a disagreement here. We might have a disagreement on this one, Alex. If you really believe the law of reciprocity for lossless antennas made out of lossless material, antennas made out of lossless material, whatever gain, pattern, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, no matter what you measure on an antenna, the transmitting characteristics and the receiving characteristics must be identical. That is the law of reciprocity. If I put an antenna into an anechoic chamber and I test the antennas. I have complete freedom to decide, will the sensing horn be the transmitter and the antenna on the test be the receiver, or vice versa? I have complete freedom to decide who transmits and who receives, and if I do it right, I get the identical data. Law of reciprocity. So my question to you, Alex, tell me what antenna you know of where the decibels of gain traceable to the IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society. Their definition of gain, by the way, is that property you measure after you have impedance match the antenna. So tell me what antenna you know of where the IEEE defined gain on reception and the IEEE defined gain on transmission is different. Is there such an antenna? And I'm talking about passive antennas that don't have any circulators inside, don't have any amplifiers inside. Within the class of low loss materials, component antennas, what antenna do you know of that has a different number of decibels of transmitting gain from its receiving gain? And to NNU, KQRIW, finally getting quiet.
Okay, Dick, and in my mind, it's not a matter of antenna, it's a matter that we are measuring. When we are measuring transmitting, we are measuring power output. When we are measuring receiving, we are measuring microvolts or volts. So half power on double power on power measurement is 3 dB. Double power on receiving is 6 dB. So that's my bottleneck.
Okay. What you said has a degree of truth. Quite often on reception, people use the units of microvolts. Another group of people will use the decibels of power on reception. Whenever I transmit with an antenna and I stand at a known distance, I'm going to get a definable amount of E field, and I can define that E field in volts per meter, or I can define that E field in watts per square meter, power flux density, or voltage E field. Or I can also define it into milliwatts of power received into an isotropic antenna at the location. I can use any system of units, any method of measurement that you would like, and as long as I do the conversions correctly, they all equal the exact same thing. If I've got 30 decibels of free space loss between two antennas, and just for simplicity, let's assume that I'm transmitting with an isotropic antenna. It's like a light bulb in a circular room, and I'm receiving with an isotropic antenna. So by definition, my transmitting antenna has 0 dB of gain over isotropic, and my receiving antenna has 0 dB of gain over isotropic. And I space them at a distance where there's 30 decibels of insertion loss between the two antennas, free space as they call it, 30 decibels. If I transmit 1 watt into antenna A, I will receive 1 milliwatt into antenna B. I can take that 1 milliwatt and convert it into 0.271 volts if you like, but it's still 1 millivolt. 1 milliwatt into a 50 ohm line. And if I don't transmit into antenna A, but I transmit into antenna B, but now I receive in antenna A, I would get the exact same result. So from that experiment, I could say transmitting gain and receiving gain are identical. Now I know you're going to say that, well, you've used the identical antenna, it's not a fair test. Well, I can now repeat the test with antennas that each have 10 dB of gain, or I can make one of them isotropic and one of them 10 dB of gain. No matter...
Repeater, timeout.
No matter what combination I use along those lines, even if one antenna is higher in gain, the other antenna is lower in gain, and if I transmit into antenna A and I receive some number of milliwatts or the corresponding number of microvolts from antenna B, and then I reverse who transmits and who receives, I'm going to get the exact same answer. I strongly believe that. You and I maybe should discuss it further if you disagree. N2NNU, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, I just felt that most of us, when we're talking about receiving, we are talking about sensitivities, and that is all most of the time expressed in microvolts per meter. Field strength meter, it's microvolts per meter, and all of this. It's very seldom that I use power when I'm talking about receive. So that was my concern here, because if you use the voltage as a point of reference, the numbers will be different than from the power. Although, when you convert them to whatever you want, yes, you can make them the same. But most of the time, you and me and probably many others, when we're talking about receiving with an antenna, we're talking about microvolts per meter rather than watts per meter. Anyhow, I guess this example shows that you have to memorize and just repeat it as a papagal and then forget it. We'll talk about isotropic receiving at another time. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, by definition, I think S9 on a receiver that's got S0 for S9 and then 10, 20, 30 all the way up to 60 dB over S9, I think S9 is defined as 50 microvolts into the front end of the receiver. And if I do an E squared over R, I get a certain amount of power. And if I convert that into decibels, no, I don't believe the number. Oh, yes, 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 yes. I forgot to convert from watts to milliwatts. You get minus 73 dBm. So S9 on every well-calibrated receiver, which if it's well-calibrated represents 50 microvolts, also represents a signal strength in milliwatts of minus 73 dBm. 73 dB weaker than a milliwatt is 50 microvolts. So I could, if I want to, take my S meter and write on that scale another whole system of units. Each S unit, by the way, is exactly 6 dB apart. So S9 is minus 73 microvolts, is minus 73 dBm. S8 is minus 79 dBm, 6 dBm weaker, and so on. Each S unit is half the voltage difference, which is 4-to-1 power difference, which is 6 dB difference. So I could if I want to. And by the way, you'll notice also, the S meter starts off at S0 and goes to S9. And what's above there? 10 dB over S9, 20 dB over S9. So the scale already has dBs and signal strength, which you and I can convert into microvolts. You could say to a smart guy looking at your S meter that's in front of you right now, I could say there are three systems of units. Let me drop. There are three systems of units on that S meter right now. There's decibels on the right-hand side, the red part of the scale. There is S units on the left side, which have a known conversion into microvolts. And every one of those microvolts into a 50-ohm receiver can be converted into dB with reference to a milliwatt, dBm. So virtually, there are dBm, there are S units, there are microvolts, and there are decibels above 50 microvolts. There's three or four systems of units, one way or another, on that S meter right now. Choose whatever system of units you want. It reminds me a little bit of the guys who measure light. They measure it in foot candles and photons. There's a zillion different units for measuring light. Well, we've got a whole lot of different units for measuring the signal strength of a radio signal, and that's just into a 50-ohm world. I could also come up with another set of units into a 70-ohm world, into a 300-ohm world. As long as you know what the guy is talking about, there is a conversion between them, and I think it makes sense. N2NNU, K2RIW.
Okay, let us drop a bit. Yeah, Dick, well, why shall I bother with conversion if everything is dBv? When I'm talking about receiving, it's dBV or dB micro V. When I'm talking about output power, I'm talking dBm. I have no confusion between those two units. I don't have a need to convert them. Anywho, I think that question was a misleading question, so we'll take that answer as it is, and that's that. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, you brought up another set of units. I didn't think about it. The people who do broadcast television, cable television, they do everything in dBmV. dB with reference to a microvolt, or is it dB with reference to a millivolt? I think it's dB with reference to a microvolt. So you have dB with reference to a milliwatt, dB with reference to a microvolt, watt, milliwatt, gain over isotropic. Oh boy, we can have a grand old time with units. The people who build amplifiers spend half their life switching back and forth between standing wave ratio as a number and reflection coefficient S11 as a ratio. So reflection coefficient or standing wave ratio. The people who work with amplifiers, for instance, spend their whole damn day flipping back and forth between the two. Because one data sheet is in one set of units and another data sheet's in another set of units. And nobody has created a standardization to bring it all down to one set of units. Everybody should talk about the reflection coefficient as a ratio and call it S11 as a scattering parameter, or everybody should call it standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio came about because when you slide a slotted line, and in the old days it used to be Letcher wires with a light bulb between the two wires, when you slide that along the line, you will see a peak in voltage in one spot and a valley in voltage in another spot, and the ratio between the peak and the valley, we call it standing wave ratio. Well, nobody uses a slotted line anymore. We all use a network analyzer, or we use a directional coupler. And the directional coupler and the Bird watt meter will tell you how many watts is flowing forward and how many watts is flowing back. And with the right conversion chart, or with the right formula, you take the raw data you get out of your Bird watt meter and you convert it into standing wave ratio, if that's what you want, or you convert it into a reflection coefficient in decibels, or as a hard ratio, if that's what you want. So it turns out that all this conversion jazz, the people who work in the world of science do it all the time. Every one of the calculator...
Repeater, time out.
Every one of the calculators you and I buy from Hewlett-Packard, Tektronix, I mean Texas Instruments, Sinclair, any of the well-respected, technically oriented, scientific computers we use, have all of those conversion factors built into it for the guy that's lazy. So, yeah, I'll admit that we do too much converting, but what's the choice? Some equations work better with one set of units than another. Some people live their life in one set of units and are in horror that they someday are going to have to live with the other set of units. Occasionally a guy comes along who says, well, I can put one foot in each world and I can live with them because I can do those conversions and I memorize a whole bunch of usual factors. I mean, a guy from Europe knows that minus 40 degrees centigrade and minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit is the same number. A guy who is trained in a medical school knows that 37 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 degrees centigrade and 98.6 Fahrenheit are both a normal temperature for a human being, and they convert back and forth. Everybody's doing converting. So we got to get on the bandwagon here, Alex. Enter NNU for any comments, K2RIW.
I think that the question is misleading. It's not it's not addressing to the public that it should be addressed. An extra amateur that is an amateur that studies for extra will not be so sophisticated to understand that the need for conversions that you already explained here. So it is is misleading because it thinks that it lets you think that you're talking about one set of numbers, for example, transmitting, and that's that. Anyhow, Dick, I think we skinned this cat enough. I think we still have some mail in the bag, no?
Oh, does Mel have mail in his bag? Oh, boy. When he comes home from the post office, he looks like Santa Claus with the mail bag. K2KEY. Well, and he puts that mail bag under his Hanukkah bush. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. I sure get a lot of it here. All right. A lot of it, unfortunately, I just can't get to, but... you were mentioning, you know, I got a cross-eyed look when recently, well, some months ago, I did a little talk in front of a group of students studying engineering in a college in the city, and when I went in and explained the impedance triangle and polar coordinates using polar notation, Dick. You can well imagine that the reaction I got because this is something also that seems like you know is I don't know just sort of faded away. It's things that we learned years ago just are not really that relevant in some ways anymore. Dick. All right, we look. Hey, in fact, here I got a couple of math ones here. Would you like to hear another one?
Yeah, just think about. Radio complex impedances, admittance, susceptance, conductance, reactance. The words go on and on and on. To a guy being hit with that jazz for the first time, he's got to say, you guys must be kidding. You can't expect me to know all of those similar sounding words, and they've all got separate meanings. Go ahead with your mailbag, Mel.
Well, you should ask them if they know what an analytical number is, by show of hands. Then you'll know to what audience you're talking about.
Analytical number or a complex number. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, you know, I doubled with Alex. I thought you turned it to me initially. I'm sorry. Okay, very good, Dick. Let me see. I'm going to read one here. Here's a nice math problem that also a person studying. Also the extra class here. Got a few math problems here that they don't quite understand. And I'll read this one to you. Measurement is made of field strength at a certain distance from a transmitter. If the transmitter power is now doubled, what should I expect to see? If the transmitter power is now doubled, the field strength at the same position will be multiplied by a factor of. Go ahead.
And the factor is square root of 2. And why is that? Because by Ohm's law, like phenomena, voltage equals current times resistance, current equals voltage divided by resistance, power equals E squared over R. You'll notice that the power is a function of voltage squared, or the other way around. Voltage squared creates a difference in power. So if I want to solve for power, power is a function of square root of applied voltage. So when you double the power coming out of a transmitter, make believe it's a light bulb in a spherical room. And just to make the numbers come out right, make believe I've got a 100-watt light bulb, and I've got a spherical room with a light bulb in the center, and the spherical room has an area of 100 square meters. So this ideal 100-watt light bulb is lighting up the room. By definition, I'm going to get 1 watt per square meter of power hitting the walls. The 1 watt per square meter, by the conversion of 377 ohms of free space, you can make believe it's a dummy load resistor. I can do the division, and I can figure out how many volts per meter that represents. 1 watt per square meter. I don't have the number right here now, but it's some number of millivolts per meter will give you 1 watt per square meter. Maybe I got it wrong. I'll calculate on the next transmission. That particular one I don't do every day, so I can't do it while talking. But doubling the power increases the voltage, but you would only double the voltage if you quadruple the power, because power is a function of voltage squared. So he hasn't quadrupled the power, he's only doubled the power. Therefore, the voltage doesn't double, it only goes up by square root of 2. I know that I didn't make it as clear as I could. Maybe on the next transmission it will be a little bit clearer. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Maybe I can clear this up a little bit. This is K2KEY. What Dick just said, maybe in a little bit different terms, that the field intensity, all right, let me make it put in my own words, I'll try. The field intensity is directly proportional to the square root of the radiated power. So, as you said, they are doubling the power. That means 2. You're taking the square root of 2, which is 1.414, I believe. Yeah, I believe it's 1.414 would be the answer that you most likely would see appear on a paper in multiple choice. I think that would be the easiest way to explain it, Dick. Go ahead.
Not forget conversions. Power, it's power. Field intensity is volts, Dick.
Yep, that's where we're going. I'm now going to go back to my previous example because it helps a little bit for me. 100 watt light bulb in a room that has 100 square meters. Each square meter gets 1 watt of power. That's just a simple linear conversion. Since power equals E squared over R, if I solve for E, E equals the square root of power times resistance. Well, my power is 1, my resistance of free space is 377, 1 times 377, square root 19.4. So, my 100 watt light bulb gives me 19.4 volts per meter. It gives me 1 watt per square meter. If I double the power of the light bulb, it's now 200 watts. That's his exact example almost. I double the power, 200 watts. Since E equals square root of P times R, P is now 2 times 377, and I take that square root, I get 27 volts. So, with a 100 watt light bulb, I get 19.4 volts per meter, real. With a 200 watt light bulb, I get 27.4 volts per meter. The ratio between those two just happens to be square root of 2. And sure enough, 0.707 if I divide one way, and 1.414 if I divide the other way. So, when in doubt, if you can think of a example, let me drop, that works for you. For me, the 100 watt light bulb in a 100 square meter room, I can calculate watts per square meter, I can calculate volts per meter. And then I can simply just double the experiment. Instead of using a 100 watt light bulb, I use a 200 watt light bulb, and I solve the one equation that I know, and now compare the answers. And they will differ by 1.414 ratio, which happens to be the square root of 2. For me, that helps. There may be a simpler way, and Mel's going to tell us. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, I got to stay away from, we can't go into deep engineering on this. So the easiest way to remember, if you double the power, that is the field intensity is directly proportional to the square root of the radiated power. So we're doubling the radiated power, as it says. So we're taking the square root of 2, which comes out to, I guess, simply put, 1.414. Correct, Dick, over.
I agree, and you've got a more direct approach. And your approach is a little bit more theoretical for a guy who's memorized the equation. My approach is a little bit more physical for the guy who wants to see it as a diagram or feel the heat of the light bulb, so to speak. And so maybe it'll help. any of these new concepts. You got to hear them a couple of times. You got to study them a couple of times. You got to think about it. It doesn't come instantaneously. Whenever you hear any of these concepts, at first they seem a little bit crazy. It's hard to believe that when my car at 30 miles an hour strikes a brick wall, it creates a certain amount of damage. If my car is moving 60 miles an hour and it strikes the same brick wall, common sense would lead you to believe you get twice as much damage. Uh-oh. You get four times as much damage. Kinetic energy is equivalent of velocity squared. Power is the equivalent of voltage squared. Not a linear relationship. The first time I heard that about destruction in an automobile, boy, I had a lot of trouble believing it. KQKEY, KQRIW.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick, wouldn't it be easier to think of it as, you know, you take a point going off into one direction, and if you're hitting a square, and whatever power is hitting that square, if you go beyond that, if you double that square, you double the distance, now you're going to have four times. If you take a point and you draw it and you connect to the four points of that square and you keep going and you double the distance, if you double the distance, you're going to come up to the equivalent of four of those equal squares that you started with. So that would be four times weaker if you double the distance. So if you wanted to have the equivalent power that you had originally from the first distance of the one square, you would have to have four times the amount of power going out to irradiate the four squares behind it that are twice the distance away to have the equivalent of power of what you started with. So it would be, you know, really like four times the distance. So if you're doubling it, you're not really going to get that much. You'd have original power to the four squares in the back, you know, and then of course beyond that, you know, it's the inverse square law going all the way out. Wouldn't that be an easier concept for just forgetting about the math? Thing. Back to you.
That's a good illustration of the inverse square law, Paul. And so to relate distance to power is what you're doing. And his original question is, what's the change in voltage I get in E field, volts per meter, when I double the power? If that diagram works for you, my light bulb works for me, Mel's equation works for him. Guarantee there's two or three more ways of looking at this, all of which will work as long as you worry about all the fine details. The laws of physics, some of them don't make a lot of common sense at first. I, for one, had a lot of trouble with finding out that my car would have four times as much damage just because I doubled its speed. I now accept the fact that there's four times as much kinetic energy. I've had to step on that accelerator for a lot longer period of time to get up to 60 miles an hour. To go from 0 to 30 miles an hour took me a certain amount of time. It takes me a lot longer to go from 30 to 60. Something more is taking place. A lot more energy is being coupled in there. Three times as much energy, in fact, from the beginning. So, kinetic energy is a function of velocity squared. Power is a function of voltage squared. Inverse square law is a function of distance squared. There's quite a few things in life that are squared. I wish I could square my money. KQKEY, KQRIW.
And WS2N. I just wanted to say that, you know, Mel recommended the MIMS book a while back, and that's what that comes out of. I mean, if whoever wrote into Mel gets a copy of those MIMS books, they have a perfect example of that, showing the one squared and the four squares behind that, and the 16 squares behind that, and you know, how it, you know, every time that they increase, you know, they double the distance. It's a real good representation of that particular thing, Dick.
Not driving a Lamborghini yet, Dick?
Jim, I have to ask you for a repeat on that in a minute. Paul, you called them the MEMS book. What does that mean, MEMS book? Spell that out or describe that to us. Is that an abbreviation? Paul, is that a S-U-N?
This guy, MIMS, M-I-M-S, he wrote it. Radio Shack sold them for years. Maybe they still sell them, I don't know. But I know Mel knows all about it, and in fact, he recommended it to me a long time ago. Back to you, Dick. Let Mel explain it. Just Mel's really up on this.
Okay, before I turn it back to Mel, what did you just say, Alex?
You were talking about acceleration. You're telling me you're not driving a Lamborghini yet? 0 to 60 in 3 seconds?
I could dream. If I had a Lamborghini right now, I'd want to convert it into cash. The rate at which it depreciates in dollars per day would bother the hell out of me. Well, if I had your money, I wouldn't worry. If I had run as many businesses as you've run, Alex, yes, just like that Mercedes that sits out in front of your house, a Lamborghini is just another expensive, good-looking car. Isn't that true?
Well, not quite, because this particular one doesn't have the bad bar inside. You can't make a martini while driving.
We can dream. Go ahead, Mel. And I guess you recommended that Paul get these MEMS books. Sounds like they're pretty good. K2KEY, K2LAW.
This is K2KEY. Yep, Forrest MEMS, the third. Nice guy. I met him, and we had quite a number of talks, and I more or less always showed many people how to solve mathematical problems such as these simply. That's why I gave the simple answer to it. You know, even for engineers, if you're not working with certain factors every day, it becomes a problem, especially us, older guys, you know, like you. You know, I'm a little younger. Shy for a few hours. But all kidding aside, it's sometimes easier to remember these things by a simpler means, Dick. That's what I'm just saying. In fact, I got a few math problems here. I don't know if we want to take them. I guess these are all people who are studying this jazz, either for their extra class license or whatever. I was going to answer a couple of them, but want me to give you one more quickie?
Fire away. And bear in mind that we're down to 9 minutes left. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Here's one. Field strength is measured at 650 microvolts if the receiving antenna is 2.5 meters long. The signal voltage induced into the antenna is? What's your answer?
Oh. The voltage the antenna picks up will be drastically different depending on whether or not the antenna is or is not resonant. If I took a non-resonant wire, I'll pick up very little voltage. Well, I guess by way of an impedance matching network, I can take any length of wire and force it to be resonant. But that changes the pattern. So there's a ungiven piece of information here. I think you said 25 meters long. And I guess we have to assume that 25 meters is half-wave resonant.
5 meters.
2.5 meters, I think you said. Okay. So 2.5 meters, we have to assume, is a resonant length, 650 microvolts per meter. I go through two or three conversions. I would first, and I'm not doing it the easiest way. The easiest way is to memorize an equation with a whole bunch of terms. You plug in the terms, you hope you get it right. I take an antenna on a known wavelength, convert it into an effective capture area of an antenna of a half-wave dipole on that wavelength, and then figure out that capture area, that many microvolts per meter, will pick up so many watts of power, and then convert that into a 50-ohm line, And by the way, that antenna will give you a different number of microvolts depending on whether or not it is a 50 ohm impedance match or a 70 ohm impedance match, or if it's a folded dipole and 300. There are a number of unknowns here that you have to make some assumptions about. The guy who wrote that particular question was looking at a formula, and he forgot about the fact that it was set up for, let's say, a 50 ohm half-wave dipole. And he thought that that wasn't at that particular frequency or that particular wavelength. And he thought that those numbers were not significant. All you got to do is plug into this memorized equation. Just like Alex's question that had really some errors in it, there's some potential errors in this question as I see it, Mel. Go ahead.
If I had to give a straightforward, simple answer to this, Dick, here's how would I do it. I'm just looking at this now, and this would strike me again. Simple. Here's what I would do if I had to give up with this information. This is the only way I could supply an answer. I would think that the signal voltage induced into the antenna is equal to the field strength multiplied by the antenna length. So if they said 650 microvolts measured, and the antenna is 2.5, 2.5 meters long, I would multiply the, let me see, am I getting this right? Let me re-picture this. Maybe I'm starting to slip here at this time of night. Yeah, I would multiply 650 microvolts by 2.5 meters, which would give me, 1600, for me to do this now in my head, I haven't got my calculator, I should always keep it next to me. It would give me, 1625 microvolts. Am I correct on the math, Dick? Over.
They don't tell you where the 650 microvolts are measured. Are they right at the antenna surface or about 2 meters away?
You have to assume that he's in a uniform field of 650 microvolts per meter. I hope it was microvolts per meter. And you're assuming now, Mel, that an antenna is a linear device. It is not. Depending on what frequency it's at. By the way, here's the problem. Oh boy, you're gonna love this one. If I was using 650 microvolts per meter, and I did it on the 40 meter ham band, and then I did 650 microvolts per meter on the 80 meter ham band, since the 80 meter antenna is twice as big as the 40 meter antenna, your mathematics would lead you to believe that you're going to pick up exactly twice the number of microvolts. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The effective capture area of an 80-meter dipole is four times as big as the effective capture area of a 40-meter dipole. Therefore, the same field strength in microvolts per meter are going to give you four times as much power, which is twice the voltage. Ooh, I'm making a liar out of myself. I know it's not a linear conversion. There is a linear relationship, but there's another factor that has to be put in here. I'll eventually figure it out. I may not give you the answer yet tonight, but we're going to work on this one. There's a little more to this than first meets the eye. There is a doubling the length of the antenna with the right frequency rearrangement. We'll double the microvolts. I'm going to give you that one. But it's not a one-to-one relationship. 1 meter of antenna is not going to pick up 650 microvolts on a field strength of 650 microvolts per meter. There's another factor in there. Back to you, Mel.
This is KTKEY. Reading exactly. In other words, at the receiving position, they're measuring 650 microvolts per meter. And at the receiving antenna, 2.5 meters long, signal that is induced, the signal induced into the antenna is, well, I gotta tell you, if I was hit with this question, I, without giving it any kind of, other questioning or just ballpark, intelligent answer, I'm gonna go by the signal voltage induced to in an antenna is equal to the field strength multiplied by the antenna length. So I'm going to say that 650 times 2.5, give me 1,625, 1,625 microvolts. Or if I rounded it off, I guess, I'd say 1.63 millivolts. I mean, that's the only intelligent answer I could give if this is the way the problem was stated to me, Dick, without any other parameters. Over.
Don't forget, the antenna being at resonance, it will, let me see if I got it, it will actually shunt the receiving voltage by its resistance. So if you have a 10 ohm resistance into the antenna, that will be in parallel with your voltage, and that will create a drop on the voltage received. So it all depends now on the antenna resistance also at resonance.
That's close. I'm going to agree with that. Also, of all the power that hits every dipole, Mel, half of it goes down the feed line, half of it gets re-radiated into space. A little more going on here. Your linear relationship of length of wire and number of microvolts gets you into the ballpark. It's close. But I think there's something like a 2-to-1 error, and we're not going to solve this one tonight. I think the guys have stumped us a little bit on this one. We're going to come back next week, because we've just run out of time. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1,243. Alex, Mel, and Dick are trying to teach each other radio science. We're making some progress. Two steps forward, one step back. We'll be back next week with a little bit more of this information. Over to you, Mel, for tying on the ribbon, K2LAW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I've got to think of answers to these things that are simple. That's the best I could come up with on this. And like you say, I'm most likely maybe in a ballpark, and I most likely would be a, for what of the information I have here, I guess it would be a reasonable answer. like I say, you know, radio engineering, you know, I've explained this to a number of people. I try to give them even simple answers in many cases, and it's hard to understand them, as Dick has said many times. The first time you hear this stuff, this so-called jazz, it is a little hard to digest. Okay, everybody, we'll try to do it again next week. 73s, have a great week. Try to keep dry. We're going to have some miserable, rainy weather this week, and we'll look forward to doing it again. 73, this is K2KEY. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think we can say a couple more words on the 147-375 machine. Maybe within 2 minutes I'll come back with an answer. Maybe. And maybe I won't. Bye-bye for now.
Before you go, Dick, did you have an opportunity to check the patent office?
Yes, I did. Beautiful patent. And I got to read more about it. That's a nice locator device between two people. In a crowd, you and your son will never get lost with those things.
Okay. Have fun there. We'll talk to you soon, Antoine, anyway.
I'm absolutely amazed, Dick. You've never heard of Forrest Mims? Oh, gosh. I bet there's several of his books in here hiding around your place. K2RIWWA5BJB.
I must have led a very sheltered life, Kent. And by the way, how many microvolts would 2.5 meters of antenna pick up?
12 AM 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater.
Oh, somewhere between a bushel and a peck, I'm sure. You've seen his book. Radio Shack, for most part, sold them. They call them engineering notebooks. And when you open them up, he has much better handwriting than I do. He would have a book on 555 timers, a book on digital circuits, a book on power supply circuits, and everything was a hand-drawn schematic, hand-printed explanation to go with it, all on quadrule paper, and it looked like you had taken his lab notebook, made photocopies of it, and sold them at Radio Shack.
I do remember seeing a zillion of these books at Radio Shack saying 101 experiments to do such and such. Was that this guy?
Usually not.